everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all the support so far on our podcast.
Please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Murder, Mother and Me Podcast. Share with your friends and write us a review.
But only if it's a good one. Welcome back, everyone, to part two of our case on the Idaho 4. If you haven't listened to part one, I suggest you go back and listen to that first before we continue. The King Road murders left Moscow reeling. Four young lives were gone, a community was shattered, and fear gripped every corner of the University of Idaho campus. But for investigators, the horror inside that house was only the beginning. They faced a puzzle unlike anything they had seen before, a crime scene soaked in blood, but strangely clean of answers. No murder weapon, no obvious fingerprints, no forced entry. Whoever had done this had slipped in and out of the house, leaving behind only chaos and a single overlooked clue, a leather knife sheath. What followed was a frantic investigation that stretched across states, pulled in federal agents, and eventually landed on one name, a man who until then lived in the shadows. Detectives arriving at the King Road house that morning described it as overwhelming. Six bedrooms, three levels, blood on multiple floors. Pools of it had seeped through mattresses, staining ceilings below. There were signs of a struggle in Zana's room, a knocked over lamp, scattered items, blood spray angled across the wall, consistent with her fighting back. Ethan's body also lay in that room, his blood dripping through the house and pooling onto the floor outside. On the floor above, on Maddie's bed, near her and Kaylee, investigators found the sheath. Tan leather, military style, for a K-bar knife. The blade was missing, but on the button snap was DNA. The crime scene team swabbed, bagged and documented every inch. Still, without an immediate match in CODIS, the National DNA database, the case stalled.
So I think if I'm not wrong, it was Ethan's blood that was actually seen dripping from the walls of the house on the outside, which just really tells you how much of a bloodbath it was in there.
What a horrible picture. I remember seeing that on when it came on the news. And at that time, nobody knew whose blood it was. But the fact, it was like a horror film, really. Like you see in those old 60s horror films with the house that, you know, wet blood or whatever. And it was just literally dripping down the outside. But for the parents, imagine if that was your child and knowing that was their blood. I mean, what a massacre that was inside.
I know. And I think massacre is the perfect word, isn't it? Because I think originally, because there was so many gag orders placed on the case and no one could speak or tell the details, it was obvious that it was bad, but I don't think people really realised how bad it was inside that house until now, you know, the files have been made public and we know the grisly details.
It's still coming out, isn't it? I think only up until very recently. I mean, they've just released the last sort of information about it that they couldn't release before. And it paints a very different picture than what was originally thought. Although at the core of it is still that these four young people were murdered, but there's so much more to it, isn't there? And it's so much worse, if it could even be worse than what you originally thought.
That's what I was going to say. You're not talking about four students here that have just been stabbed. Like, it's
I think that's what everyone thought, isn't it? It was just someone randomly went in and stabbed them, but this was literally like a bloodbath, wasn't it?
I mean, and that would be bad enough, but really they've been brutalised, haven't they? They've been absolutely massacred. It's not just a case of he's gone in and done it quickly.
It's that word, isn't it? Overkill again.
Overkill, completely. Just that picture of the blood dripping down the wall outside is so eerie.
When they say a picture paints a thousand words, I think that actually in one picture makes you realise what had gone on in the house.
And also, I wonder if the killer realised at some point that he dropped the sheath in the bedroom. Because like we spoke about in episode one, he was obviously in some kind of frenzy. Maybe some kind of state that he didn't even really know what was going on himself. He was just going on pure instinct and adrenaline.
Well, we can come to the theories later, but obviously he left this knife sheath behind, not on purpose, because he didn't want to get caught, I'm guessing. But I think at some point he must have realised that he had left it behind. Then came the surveillance review. Moscow police and FBI agents began pulling footage from traffic cameras, home security systems and business parking lots. On multiple cameras, they spotted it. A white Hyundai Elantra, model years 2011 to 2016.
The car circled the King Road neighbourhood again and again between 3:30 and 4:20 a.m. In one clip, it slowed as if casing the area. In another, it sped away minutes after the estimated time of the murders. The FBI created a database of every Hyundai Elantra registered within hundreds of miles. One stood out, a 2015 white Elantra registered to a man named Brian Christopher Koberger, living just 10 miles away in Pullman, Washington. So who was this man, Brian Christopher Koberger? Born in 1994 in Pennsylvania, Brian grew up in the Pocono Mountains. In high school, classmates remembered him as awkward and bullied for his weight. Later, he lost more than 100 pounds, but his personality shifted, withdrawn, rigid, sometimes arrogant. He studied psychology at Northampton Community College, then criminal justice at DeSales University, where he earned a master's degree. At DeSales, he studied under Dr. Catherine Ramsland, a criminologist renowned for her work on serial killers. Koberger even posted online surveys asking criminals to describe their thoughts and feelings while committing crimes, their emotions, decisions, and impulses. In 2022, he moved across the country to begin a PhD in criminology at Washington State University, just a short drive from Moscow. Students described him as condescending. Female classmates said he made them uncomfortable. Others noted his obsession with crime discussions, his eagerness to insert himself into conversations about serial killers, forensic psychology, and methods of murder. He also worked as a teaching assistant. Some students complained about his harsh grading and rigid behaviour. By late 2022, he was reportedly on the verge of losing that position. Investigators believe he began surveilling the Kings Road house months before the murders, circling the area late at night. Why that house? Why those victims? No clear motive has ever been revealed. But when you put the evidence together, the man who studied killers had crossed over into becoming one.
Okay, so now we know the name of the man that at this point they suspect is the killer.
And surprisingly enough, he's a criminologist. Which kind of, the first thought I've got about that is, was he actually studying criminology because he wanted to be a criminal? Or did he kind of become a criminal because he read so much about it and thought he'd be good at that particular job?
Yeah, I wonder if he was already having these thoughts before he'd gone to study criminology,
and
or whether
that's what attracted him to.
Exactly.
Although I did read somewhere at one point he wanted to be a policeman. And it's funny really, because there's been a number of cases where serial killers or killers have kind of had that sort of aim to be a policeman at one point, or in law enforcement. Ted Bundy, I think, he was in law. You know, that kind of thing. It goes along those lines.
I think, just from the way he's described by his fellow classmates and stuff, he's a weirdo, isn't he? Let's face it. He's a weirdo.
It depends what you call a weirdo, doesn't
it? No, he's
it?
A weirdo, and he looks like a weirdo. And if no, like I said in the first part of this two-part, if you haven't seen a picture of him, you need to go and look immediately, because if you look up the definition of a serial killer in a dictionary, there should be a picture of this fella, because he just looks like a killer. I don't know how that's possible,
but
he does.
That's the thing, because I always say this, don't I? If you look like a killer, you probably wouldn't get away with it, but he is sort of like a textbook definition of someone you'd want to, you'd look at him and think he's a bit strange. But, you know, we've all got sort of quirks and things, haven't we? And some people are quite awkward. It doesn't mean you're a serial killer, does it? You know, you could have all those traits and not be a serial killer. So maybe it wasn't apparently obvious. Although I've got to say that with all these files being released, more things are coming out now. There was a lot of complaints about him. Even one of his professors at college actually made a statement and said, I'm just paraphrasing really, but he's clever enough to get his master's degree. And if he does, we're going to have a problem, because he's going to be somebody who's going to be on the radar for harassing students, women students, and all that kind of thing. So they obviously picked up on something, and so they should as well, because that's supposed to be their job.
Well, I was going to say, so he was on people's radars for being a bit of a creep.
Well,
already.
There was lots of complaints from female students as well that it came to light now, because he was an assistant teacher as well. So he must have been quite intelligent. You know, he was obviously intelligent, but I mean, he must have stood out to them to apply for that job and actually get that job. And they'd go into the room to see him because he had an office on the campus, and he wouldn't let them out the room. He'd stand in the doorway and he'd tower over them, and he was quite misogynistic in that he would grade the females' papers lower than the male papers. When he was going to classes himself, if it was a female professor he was going into, or, you know, teacher, he would he would be late for the class. And so he obviously had this problem with women. And some might say it was because he wasn't successful with women, if you like.
I was going to say, is this like a bit of an incel situation?
Well, that's what's,
what they think is motivated.
Yeah, is one of the theories, yeah.
So we've established as well that he also lived and worked in Washington, which is around 10 miles away from Moscow. So it's really not that far at all.
I didn't actually realise it was that close. When you say Washington State and...
You think it's just miles away, don't you?
It sounds like miles away, but he obviously lived close... They live close to the border. Moscow's quite close to the border between the two states. But, you know, Idaho and Washington, it just sounds like miles away to me.
And I think the fact that he was a criminology student and he was so into, like, you know, methods of killing people and crime scenes and serial killers and all that, this comes into play later on, I think, because he did make quite a few mistakes, I think.
I was going to say, for somebody who actually studied criminology as a career, he made some real rookie mistakes, didn't he? I mean, why would you be driving the same car that it's actually registered in your name? And also, while we're on the subject, I believe that he had multiple driving citations just for, you know, things like not wearing a seatbelt, going too fast, tailgating another car. So his name would be, he would be aware surely of that fact, that his name could be flagged if they searched for him.
Well, that's what always confused me, because as far as we're aware, he was stopped at least on two occasions by police. This is before the murders, prior to the murders. And he spoke to the police, and there's videos of this online, and he's quite well-spoken, he's quite intelligent, he's having a normal conversation with the policewoman. But the police are obviously going to make a note of that, what his name was, what car he was driving, what the reg is. So why would he then keep driving that car?
I've seen those video clips, and as you say, he's intelligent, he's polite and respectful. He even says to the, even offers up the fact that he wasn't wearing a seatbelt and says, I just want to be honest, which is just ironic, really. And he would know that that car that he's driving is a, you know, a specific type, and they surely will be able to see it on CCTV because it's everywhere now. And they'd narrow that down to a pool of cars in that area if it was registered there. And then they'd narrow it down further and further until it came to him. Even if there was like 10,000 cars on it, they would keep narrowing it down and they would go and interview the owners of those cars. He must have known that. So it baffles me, really.
It is baffling, especially because of his background in criminology and stuff. It just seems careless and stupid, and for someone that does have, like, a relatively high intelligence level.
Yeah, it's like criminology 101, is it? It's just the first thing you will think of. Don't take your own car.
Yeah, there's something about that just doesn't make sense to me. And also, I think when they were looking for the car in the databases and stuff, I do think they found a couple of others that were similar matches, and eventually they realized that it was a different year they were looking for or something, and that's what narrowed them into Brian's car. And then I think there was only one car in that area that matched it, which, you know, turned out to be his. But
then given the surviving witnesses' statements, it kind of looked like him as well, didn't it? But when he got stopped by the police, he actually said, they asked him for his telephone number, his cell phone number, and he said, why do you need this? It made me think that he was aware that, you know, that was sort of like another thread to him, even more, sort of more personal. So I think he was a bit aware of it, but why?
I just don't know why you'd use your personal car when you're about to commit a crime like this. Regardless of whether he went in to commit that actual crime, he was going in the house to commit a crime of some form.
And he must have planned it, so it's not like randomly one night he thought, I'm just going to go and do it, and he didn't think about it. He'd already planned it. He'd actually bought online, which is another strange thing, so we'll just talk about that for a second. The knife that he used was a hunting knife used by, as we said before, you know, military and stuff. And he bought it on Amazon with a gift card. So it could be traced, I don't know. We're laughing because it just sounds so ridiculous that he'd buy it with a gift card as well. But even just buying it online at Amazon, he didn't go into a shop and use cash or whatever, you know, he bought it online. So there was you know, if they were going to search that, and they can do these things now, and they knew what area it was in, it would have been even easier. And I can't get my head around the fact that he'd do something like that.
I mean, I think it's more laughable because we know his background in criminology. Like, I think most criminals are quite dumb. They always make stupid mistakes. They always leave fingerprints, or they leave something, or DNA, or whatever, or drive their own car. But with him and his background in criminology and being interested in it and probably looking at a million different murder cases and researching them, I feel like he's just took no steps whatsoever to conceal his identity.
It's almost like, I don't think he actually I don't know whether he wanted to be caught or not, but it did cross my mind at one point that as he set this whole thing up to kind of prove that he could actually do it and get away with it or get caught. And I just don't know what reasoning there is behind this, because he also bought an all-in-one suit, and he bought like some kind of balaclava type thing.
That's what I was going
to
say.
And it's all traced back to him. He had receipts in his flat. You would know, wouldn't you, if that on the off chance maybe that he were caught, he would dispose of all that kind. He disposed of the actual things he wore, which they've never found. He wore some kind of zip-up suit, you know, like an overall coverall thing. And he wore this like balaclava type thing, and he bought the knife and he left the sheath behind. But they could all be traced back to him, but they've never found any of them.
And when they were saying that, you know, they put the DNA into CODIS and they didn't get a hit of that, but that's because he'd never actually been charged with an official crime. He'd just been traffic cited on the motorway a couple of times. Okay, so we've established that he lives not far from Moscow. We've established that he's a criminology student, he's a teacher's assistant, he's an absolute A-star creep. Everyone gets weird vibes from him. But what I've never been able to understand is why these students in Idaho from that university, he must have crossed paths with them somewhere along the line and seen them.
Well, they were quite close. They lived in close proximity, really, didn't they? 10 miles is nothing, is it? Especially in America.
No, not at all.
But I'll tell you something else about what makes it even creepier is he got matched online with some lady that he went on a date with, some girl. She said he wanted to go back to her residence and have coffee or something, and he went back. He started being really weird and stuff, so she made an excuse, said she felt sick, and he went home. Then he started sending a message saying, basically, you've got great childbearing hips and stuff like this. I mean, it's just bizarre. And then another time, he was actually in the university itself, and I think it was somebody who worked on reception or somebody who worked there. They started just chatting as they were walking along, and he started asking her, they were talking about horror films and things, and he was asking her what way would she like to be killed, basically. And it's just, it's chat up lines, it's just not something you go for.
Yeah.
And she said the worst way to die would be by a stabbing, and he then said with a K-bar knife. And then that wasn't released at the time, so that shows some element that he had this in his mind.
Well, it's like it's definitely got to be some kind of fantasy, hasn't it? That's what it is.
And then later on as well, when they started searching records and his computer and stuff like this, he'd actually, because they tried to say that this killing was not a sexually motivated killing, but then when they found, and it wasn't released, but evidence on his computer, you know, is what he'd been searching for, was things like girls unconscious while you raped them and gagged, you know, so how does that not even come into play? But that wasn't released. The next evidence the police looked into was the cell tower data. Analysts pulled pings from towers near the victim's home. They discovered that Koberger's phone had connected to towers near King Road at least 12 times in the months before the murders, nearly all of them late at night or early morning. On the night of November the 13th, his phone went dark, powered off at 2:47 a.m. It stayed off during the entire window of the murders, then at 4:48 a.m., after the killings, it turned back on. The phone then travelled south towards his apartment in Pullman before pinging towers near Moscow again later that morning, as if he had returned to see the aftermath. But the most damning piece of evidence remained the DNA found on the knife sheath. By December, investigators tracked Koberger's movements back to his family's home in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania. FBI agents conducted covert surveillance. One night, they retrieved trash bags from the curb outside the Koberger home. Inside was DNA from Brian's father. Testing revealed a match. The DNA on the knife sheath came from someone who was the biological child of the man whose DNA was in that trash. Statistically, the odds of it belonging to anyone other than Brian Koberger were over 99.9998%. The evidence was stacking up.
Let's try and dissect all of that. So the let's start with the phone. So the phone pings. Sorry, can I just say again? Is he fucking thick? I don't understand what's going on.
So basically he was driving around for a month or so before the actual murders. Why was he even there then if he wasn't watching these students?
Well, it's obvious why he was there, yeah. He was obviously surveilling the house, seeing the comings and goings, seeing probably, it said most of the time it was late at night or really early in the morning. So he was I imagine he was standing there thinking, right, well, this is a perfect window of opportunity for me to go in when it looks like the least people are active in the house.
Or they're asleep.
Or they're asleep, yeah.
So afterwards, they interviewed a lot of friends and family and acquaintances, and they did say that Kaylee especially felt like she was being followed, and she'd mentioned it on a couple of occasions, and she had this dog, Murphy, was just a puppy, and she'd let him out of a night time. And as this, we've mentioned before, there was sort of like a wooded area behind the house, and the dog had ran into those woods and barked on a number of occasions and wouldn't come back. So from that vantage point of the woods, you could look directly into this house, into the girls' bedrooms, because most of the time they'd have the lights on, because they didn't think about things like that. And you could, you know...
Would you think about things like
well,
that?
Well, exactly. So somebody hidden in the woods could see exactly what was going on.
I think I seen something online as well about there being some kind of car park behind those woods, and that's where they think he used to park his car, and then he'd walk through the woods to that vantage point that you're talking about, where he could see everything. And I guess he was probably trying to just get a feel for any kind of routine that they would be in. You know, most people go to bed at a similar time every night, pretty much, give or take the odd night where they might go on a night out or something. But I feel like he was really looking for a routine of like a window of time that he knew that it was probably safe for him to go in.
He was looking for the most vulnerable time to be able to go in unnoticed, and when they would be unaware basically of what was going on. And another thing was, they never really locked that door. I think we've mentioned that before. And they come home one day and that door was open, and they just assumed it was like the wind had blown it open.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think anyone really locked their doors in that area, is what it seems, especially in the student, like, you know, the fraternity houses and stuff. It said that most people just had an open door policy. It was just always open.
But it makes me almost certain that he's been in the house while they've not been there. He's gone and he's watched, and he's gone in at some point.
Well,
I
that
think.
Would make sense, wouldn't it? If he's been surveilling the house and he's seen, right, at this time, on these days, they all go to uni for classes, so I'm going to slip in. And kind of, it goes back to what we were saying in part one about he must have been somewhat familiar with the layout of that house.
But then the phone pings were late at night or early morning. That doesn't mean to say, though, that he hasn't gone there early in the morning and gone in, maybe even to do it then and come back out again.
Yeah.
He must have known by watching that they slept late, because I remember seeing an interview with one of the roommates, one of the surviving roommates afterwards, and she said when they got up on that morning, they don't normally get up till 9 or 10 o'clock. So he could go in at 6 o'clock in the morning and know they're going to be asleep, or, you know, it's a good sort of chance they'd be asleep. He could have gone in, as I say, maybe even to do the crime and, you know, thought better of it and come out, he's heard a noise, or just to actually see the house.
It just goes back to, you know, on everything I've read about this case or listened to about this case, every single expert says how much of a weird layout that house was, and you would have to know the layout to do something like this, to go in through that sliding door, to know your way around the corridors and the stairways and stuff like that. So I have no doubt that he's been in that house before he committed that crime.
So tell me this then, who do you think the intended victims were?
Well, that's what I was going to touch on next, because I think he's had someone in mind to go to that house so many times. I think it said 12 times or something in the months prior to the murder. He was going there for a reason, so he's obviously seen one of the girls. I think the most common one that people talk about is probably Maddie. I think he had a fixation on Maddie, and I think he'd probably seen her, I don't know, maybe on a night out, or he was driving through Idaho and he'd seen her going to campus or something. And this is what these type of killers do. They fixate on people, don't they?
Yeah, I, like you, think it was Madison Mogan who was the target, the original target, which is sad, really, because he'd spotted her and gone in, he ended up, this whole thing happened, and it was in no way her fault. But how did he spot her? There's a number of ways they could have come into contact, I suppose. He wasn't that far from where they lived, where they actually went to university. He could be driving around and just spot them on the street. But I know two of the girls, it was Maddie and Zana, worked in a restaurant called the Mad Greek Restaurant, which was a vegetarian restaurant, and he was a vegetarian. So did he by chance go in there? He'd actually also, they found, which has just recently come out, that it was in his search history. So did he go there? Is that where he saw her? Or was that sort of maybe when he was kind of stalking them? Because I do believe that he did stalk them.
I think he did stalk them, but I think it would have started from him probably just going to that restaurant for some vegetarian food, and he's seeing a waitress. And again, it doesn't need to be anything. She could have just smiled at him, and that's enough to set him off. This is how these narcissistic, psychopathic brains work.
Or he just saw her on the street and followed her to see where she worked and stuff like that, and maybe wants an interaction of some kind.
But I think it's nothing that Maddie's done in terms of gave him interest or anything like that. I think
no,
it could have been something
not.
Simple, like, hi, how are you today? Or a little smile, like I said, and he's really held on to that.
I think you've got to remember as well that the girls in the house, particularly Madison and Kaylee, were that epitome of sort of American beauty. So they were blonde, you know, really nice looking girls, you know, clever, funny, everything that he wasn't really. And, you know, was that the motive? He's obviously been rejected by women. So was that the motive for this crime?
And just lastly, it said, just touching back on the phone thing again, it said that the phone pinged later on in the morning after the murders had been committed, and I think we're both under the same impression that he'd got away from the scene and thought, shit, I've left that knife sheath. He's realised at some point, and he's thought, I'm going to go back and I'm going to see if they're even awake yet, because I might be able to slip back in and grab that knife sheath and get back out.
Even that is just such a weird thing to do, to actually go back to the scene of the crime after you've murdered four people. Why would you even do that? I mean, you wouldn't even think about re-entering the house, surely.
Well, I just think he's probably not in any kind of frame of mind to be thinking rationally, and he's probably thought, I don't have any other choice but to go back and try and get that knife sheath, because that is going to tie me to this crime.
But again, what is very strange about all of this, which, you know, sort of seals his fate as well in a way, is that he turned his phone off. His phone was active and it was manually turned off right before those murders, so it was like an hour before he went, and that window of time from the beginning to the end was dark, and then he turned it back on something like half an hour, 40 minutes later. Does he not think that looks suspicious?
You may as well just write on your phone, I did it.
It didn't go off. He manually turned it off. So what reason can he give for that?
But this is also, again, just going back to the criminology thing of him being a student, like, just leave your phone at home. So then if at least they check your records, his phone's not left his house, so that kind of works in his favour. Why are you taking your phone with you?
He must know he's going to be on some camera footage somewhere, whether it's going down a highway towards their residence or down them streets. Most homeowners now have got, like, you know, a camera on the house. Why would he must know the car's going to be pulling up round about the time of the murders and then seeing leaving and then coming back again. He's digging his own grave, really.
Well, I think there's no real getting out of it for him at this point, is there? Because all of the evidence, the DNA, the camera footage of the car, the phone records, it's all pointing to him. Now they've narrowed it down to his parents' house. They've got the DNA. It's a match to him.
And it's really strange, isn't it, the way they got that DNA? Not strange, it's what they do, isn't it? Because once you put rubbish outside your house, it's anybody's property. It's not your property anymore. And they've dug through the trash, found something with his father's DNA on and matched it, and they've gone backwards, really reversed it, haven't they? And come on, you know, the odds of it being anybody else are just...
Well, it said, didn't it? It was like 99.9998%, which is, you know, it's him.
And it come from the household's trash. You know, if they just found it on a random road, you could maybe say there was a small chance, but no. But just going back again to who the target was, I definitely think it was Madison. And he's not expected Kaylee to be there because she shouldn't have been staying over that night, and maybe he knew that, or he didn't know that, but expected her even at the very least to be in another room. And he's panicked, I think, when she's been there. He's had to fight sort of two of them. And then he's tried to flee the scene and bumped into Zana, and then Ethan's been there. And I think, as we've said before, that it was collateral damage, really, they were.
Yeah.
And it was nobody's fault. It wasn't any of those girls' fault. But, you know, I think that's been the motive for him going in, and it's been one target, and he's just kind of... It's set off a chain of events that he's not expected.
And maybe that's why he's slipped up, as we've said before, with like leaving the knife sheath and stuff like that, I think. And that's why, in my mind, he's gone back to that scene, because I don't think he's even thought that his car's on the camera, his mobile phone records. I think he's just fixated on that knife sheath and wanting to get it back.
He's gone in expecting to find one girl in bed. I think he was probably going to gag her or assault her. And that's what he thought's going to happen. And he's not allowed for all these sort of other factors coming into play. On December 30th, 2022, at 1:30 a.m, tactical teams surrounded the Koberger family home in Pennsylvania. Inside, they found Brian awake in the kitchen, wearing latex gloves, carefully placing items into Ziploc bags. His white Hyundai Elantra sat in the driveway. They arrested him on 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of burglary. The manhunt was over, but the legal battle was just beginning.
Even the fact that he was stood in his mum and dad's kitchen at 1:30 in the morning with latex gloves on.
I nearly started laughing when I was reading that. Not
like,
that
if that doesn't just give you creep vibes, I don't know what does.
I just had this picture in my mind, you know, because if you see him, you'll know what we mean. With these latex gloves on, standing in the kitchen at 1:30, what was he putting into Ziploc bags? I think it was his own stuff, like his own trash and things. He was kind of, what's that,
OCD.
OCD, yeah. Because after, you know, later on, they had footage of him in wherever he was, they were holding him, and he was doing really weird stuff, lining things up and everything.
Apparently he has like an obsession with washing his hands. His hands always have to be clean. Yeah. So when you see footage of him, his hands are always red raw, like they need a good moisturiser on.
I believe when he first went into the prison system, whoever it was that was in the cell next door to him, or I don't think he was in a cell with anybody, said he was one of the most intelligent people I've met in here, but in the end he just drove you insane because he just washes hands every 5 minutes, 2 minutes,
and do you know what, this just baffles me. It makes me even more baffled that he is so OCD about stuff, yet he made so many mistakes. It does, like, he's so clinical about certain things, but with stuff like trying to not drive the same car, like turning his phone off, making it really obvious, leaving the knife sheath behind. I don't know, it just doesn't add up, does it?
It's such a contrast, isn't it?
Such a contrast.
You know, on one hand, he's like obsessed with detail sort of thing, and on the other, he just literally did this crime without thinking about it. Well, he did think about it, that's the point, but not, he didn't cover himself, did he, at all? The road from arrest to trial was long. Extradited back to Idaho in January 2023, Koberger appeared in court, shackled in a red jumpsuit, expressionless as the charges were read. His defence filed motion after motion, challenging the DNA collection from the trash, arguing the phone records were circumstantial, claiming the Elantra video was too grainy to prove identity, requesting a change of venue, saying Moscow's small community made a fair trial impossible. Despite these efforts, the case moved forward. By the time the trial began in 2025, Moscow was transformed. Satellite trucks lined the courthouse. Journalists from across the country filled the town. Locals lined up at dawn to watch proceedings. On one side of the courtroom sat the families of the victims, clutching photographs, holding each other's hands, their grief palpable. On the other side sat Koberger, often scribbling on a yellow legal pad, rarely showing emotion. Prosecutors methodically laid out the case. Surveillance shown the Elantra circling King Road repeatedly that night. Cell tower records proving Koberger's pattern of late-night visits to the area. The knife sheath DNA tied directly to him through his father. Dylan's eyewitness account of a masked man with bushy eyebrows. Jurors watched as the puzzle pieces locked together.
So I think the creepiest thing about watching him in court is that he was just completely expressionless, completely emotionless. He didn't show any kind of anything, really, did he? He was just blank.
He was like an automaton. He just sat there and didn't move. Well, actually, all he did was blink his eyes now and again, but he hardly blinks either, which is a bit disconcerting when you're watching him.
There was no kind of emotion whatsoever. It just looked like he was, I don't know, like he wasn't even alive. And the whole time that all these proceedings are going on, his plea that he entered was not guilty. The whole time he was saying, not guilty, not guilty.
So, yeah, he continued to protest his innocence for like 2 years. And the defence lawyer, Ann Taylor, she did a really, really good job, though. I mean, whether you like it or not, that's a defence lawyer's job, isn't it? So her interest was to defend him and obviously try and get him off with the charge. Because at this point now, it wasn't just life imprisonment, it was the death penalty.
Yeah, I was just going to say the prosecutors were seeking the death penalty, weren't they?
And the state of Idaho were bringing back the firing squad as the form of capital punishment, especially for him, I might add. So that's the way he would have died. So he protested his innocence for 2 years, and this woman had done her very, very best to defend him, and she's a really good lawyer as well. And then suddenly, as the trial was coming up, it was approaching maybe a month or so ahead, the time was already, as it said, there was news trucks all coming into play, obviously trying to interview people prior to the trial. Suddenly, he pled guilty because the prosecution offered him a plea deal, which is a bit of a mystery to me even now.
Well, I think the plea deal was offered to take the death penalty off the table. I think he'd probably come to the realisation that he'd rather spend the rest of his life in prison than die.
Yeah, from his point of view and the defence's point of view, but why did the prosecution do that? What did they gain from that? Because it seems to me they had like a slam dunk case that they were going to go for the death penalty and he was going to be found guilty. So what did they gain from it? And I know some of the victims' families weren't happy about that. I wouldn't be happy about that,
to be honest.
Well,
I was going to say, I'm sure like the prosecutors in O.J. Simpson thought they had a slam dunk case.
Well, this is what they always say, isn't it? There's never such thing as that. And I know that, but it makes me wonder if there was a piece of evidence that...
I don't know. I can only assume that there was a doubt somewhere in there that they might not get a guilty verdict. And I don't know how and I don't know why, but I don't... Yeah, like you said, I don't know what the prosecutors have to gain by accepting this plea deal.
I mean, it wasn't even as if they bartered with him about anything. For instance, as I said before, they never found the knife, they never found the clothing he wore. I believe that Kaylee was assaulted, they think, with a second weapon, or possibly it was the butt of the knife because her face was so badly damaged. They never even sort of, as I say, bargained with him to say, show us where you got rid of the evidence, or why did you do this crime? So the victims' families, which were split, it was two victims' families wanted to take the plea deal, the other two didn't. They never really got any answers. They may never have got an answer anyway, or he may have lied about it, but there didn't seem to be that element of bargaining.
I was going to say, they didn't get any real answers, but what they did get is 100% conviction.
It's kind of like he got off easy, sort of.
Well, he got off easy in the sense of, he deserved way more than life in prison, in my opinion, but...
Or is that or is that possibly even worse than death, to be honest?
Well, yeah, penalty? Some say it is, but I think in terms of the prosecutors, they must have had a doubt about the case somewhere in order to accept this plea deal, and accept a plea deal that didn't even include him having to explain anything.
To actually offer a plea deal, because it's them that offers the...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they say to them, listen, we will remove the death penalty if you... accept, if you plead guilty and accept these terms. I think what it did was it kind of put an end to the case, and it saved the state an awful lot of money. That's all I can say, and I think that was part of the reason why it was done.
I just can't understand why the plea deal wouldn't have been offered and said, we'll offer you this plea deal on the basis that you tell us why you committed this crime, how you committed this crime, and just further details of like why those students, why the house. Like, the I think the hard thing for the families is that they're never going to get anything from him now. They're never going to know an explanation of
and
why.
And I think you often find as well that although your first instinct is to say, I don't want to know about the way they died or whatever, I think from the victim's family's point of view, it's kind of like almost imagining the worst. So you need to know, because you need to be able to kind of accept it and digest it and know that. And so your mind isn't all over the place, as horrible as that may be. They want to know what the final moments were like and everything. I find it really strange, but I think unless you're in that position, you can't understand that.
No, and I think the hardest thing for everyone involved in this case is just that he's not going to explain anything now. He's not going to tell anyone why he did it. He's not going to tell anyone why it was them.
You do know, don't you, that the point that... The thing is, he's in prison for the rest of his life, and he won't ever come out, I don't think. But that's if he even survives in prison, because that's another whole issue, isn't it? He's got a big target on his back with other prisoners as well. So at the moment, I think he's in solitary confinement, and he may very well stay in solitary confinement for the rest of his life, which would drive you insane, wouldn't it? But they've already said that there's probably going to be a book deal. There's probably going to be... I mean, there's a law called the Son of Sam Law, which was made after... the killer David Berkowitz, who had the name the Son of Sam, kind of made money out of the crime. But I don't think it applies in this state, because that's what it's like in America. Every state's like a mini country, isn't it? So they all have their own laws and etc. And so he's very likely going to have some kind of book deal, or criminologists going in to study him the way he studied other criminals. And so he's going to kind of get his story out. But what he says, whether he ever does reveal a motive or the exact circumstances of the crime, I really don't know. But he's going to be there for years, so he's going to want a little bit of attention, I think, at some point. The fact that all these people are going to study him, because let's face it, they are going to study him, it gives him the sort of verification of himself, doesn't it?
Makes him infamous, doesn't it?
Because before this, he was online, not online, sorry, he'd written things, I'm not really sure where, to be honest, years prior to this, saying he felt like nothing, he felt like empty, he didn't have feelings. So the warning signs were there. Whether anyone ever saw these writings, I don't know. And actually, when they went to look at his apartment, where he stayed, I think it was on campus, when he was working at the university and studying at the university. Have you seen his apartment? It's just the most basic thing you could ever see. So it's like a bed, a small sofa, just everything is just...
It looks like exactly what I expected it to look like a serial killer's
it's
apartment.
It's like there's no personality there, isn't it? No personality
But he doesn't
at
seem
all.
To have a personality.
No, he doesn't.
He seems very blank, very emotionless, very just like cold.
Very remorseless, just like he doesn't have any feeling at all. Then came the voices that cut deepest. Kaylee's mother described her daughter as the spark of our family, her absence leaving silence that feels unbearable. Maddie's stepfather spoke of the agony of planning a funeral for a 21-year-old. Her mother said she still kept Maddie's childhood room untouched. Zana's father recalled her wit, her sarcasm, and the unbearable weight of waking each moment knowing she is gone. Ethan's siblings, his triplet brother and sister, said losing him felt like losing a piece of themselves. His mother described their home as quiet, the laughter gone. The courtroom wept with them. Even seasoned reporters left in tears.
I think it's just, I've seen all of these impact statements from the families, and I think it's really, really sad just hearing them try and come to terms with what's happened.
I think the hardest part is, when you watch them, is they're trying to put into words, they're trying to put into a few paragraphs, really, what that person meant to them and what their life meant. And that's so hard, because how can you convey that to people who don't know them? And I think they did a really good job. I think if you follow this case and watch this case and watch these victims' impact statements, Kaylee's sister, Olivia, was the main one that people sort of zoned in on, just for what she said and the way she said it, because she was quite defiant, really. And she faced him, didn't she, and made eye contact with him. And as we've just said, he sat there staring blankly ahead. But I think she really got to him by what she said, because she basically said he was a non-entity and he was what he always feared he'd be, which was nothing. She had some choice remarks to say to him, so people need to watch that, really. But I noticed he blinked a lot more during hers than he did in any others, so I think she did get to him.
What I thought was quite clever is that she also used some of his own questions that he'd asked in one of his master's papers that he'd wrote about crime scenes and how would you have got away with the murder. And
it was one of his questionnaires, wasn't it, aimed at sort of criminals. Why did you choose your victim? What were the victim's last move? You know, things like that, wasn't it? You know, and she put that into her victim impact statement.
And basically asked him his
him,
own questions.
Asked him his own questions, yeah.
And I think what was really eerie was the fact that when all of these family members were getting up and speaking pretty much directly to him, most of them looking him in the eye, there was still just nothing.
Nothing.
There
didn't
was absolutely
flinch,
nothing.
Did he?
He didn't flinch.
I think hers got to him the most, especially when she said to him, which I really like this bit, when she asked him those questions that he had actually put in his own questionnaire, and she said, so sit up straight when I'm talking to you. And I don't think he would have liked that, because once she was a woman, right, that was the main thing, and he couldn't do anything, you know. And for him to be sat there having to take
spoken
this,
down to by a woman.
Yeah, being spoken down to by a woman, he wouldn't have liked that. And I think they said you could see his jaw tightening, and I think he really didn't like that.
I think the best statement that I heard was...
I know what's coming here. There was two, actually.
Yeah, from Kaylee's youngest sister, Aubrey. She said something, again, I'm paraphrasing, but she said something along the lines of, you may have got A's in your grades, but you'll be getting a lot of big D in prison. And I thought that was just brilliant.
And I think one of my favourite statements as well was from Olivia, Kaylee's older sister, who said, if you hadn't attacked them like a paedophile in the night, Kaylee would have kicked your effing ass. That's what she said. And I love that. And he had to sit there and listen to that. And, you know, normally people were surprised, journalists and stuff, we've talked about it, said they were surprised that the court actually allowed that to happen, because they were really demeaning statements, but they actually allowed it. And actually, after Olivia's statement, which you don't see on any of the video clips, there was a round of applause from the court. So I think it's what everyone wanted to say, really. Because let's face it, he was a coward, wasn't he? They were young women, and he attacked them in the middle of the night when they were asleep. And maybe Kaylee would have done that. Maybe she would have. And I think it was also hard to watch the men in the courtroom. So there was Kaylee's father, particularly. He turned the podium to face him directly on.
He wanted them to know that he was talking directly to him, didn't he?
Yes. And Zana's stepfather as well. He was really angry, wasn't he? And he said something to the effect that he wanted to take him out into the woods, but he wouldn't kill him, and he was going to hell and all this. But you could see the anger, and I think it must be so hard. How would you stop yourself from leaping across that courtroom because he was really close to them as well.
Well, I think the hard thing is as well, when you're so emotionally heightened like that and he's sitting there not giving anything back, it's almost better if they got a reaction.
It's almost like provocative, isn't it? Because it doesn't even affect him. Yeah. Not even defiant, just can't be bothered. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. It meant nothing.
And like you can say whatever you want to me, but you're still not going to get a reaction from me.
Yeah, just I think that's just the way he is, though. I don't think he does that on purpose.
I think he is emotionless. I don't think he feels like
it's
a normal person.
It's basically like talking to a brick, isn't it? You know, so how frustrating that must be. In July 2025, after weeks of testimony, the judge sentenced Brian Koberger to 4 consecutive life sentences without parole. He declined to speak at sentencing. He showed no visible remorse. Some families expressed relief that the legal process was over. Others said life in prison was too merciful for the devastation he caused. I mean, even when he appeared at trial and he declined to speak, I think that's wrong really, but he didn't even have to say the victims' names. It was sad really, because when they read it out, they would say to him, "Are you guilty as charged of killing?" And they would say like the name, like Madison Morgan, a human being. And he'd just say, yes.
Yeah, his response
but
was yes.
But the fact that they said a human being, I just thought was really sad. And he just didn't care, did he?
This is the part that I don't agree with at all from the prosecution side. I think there should have been some clause in that plea deal that he had to say something. But the fact is,
it's like he didn't acknowledge it.
He didn't
really
have to say anything at all. All he had to reply was, "Are you guilty of this?" Yes. Yeah, "Are you guilty of this?" Yes.
It was very sterile, wasn't it? Very. The victims didn't come into it. And I know one of the family members said, "All I will say is the legal system is set up to protect the criminal, not the, you know, it's all in their favour."
Well, certainly in a plea deal like this, it is. Yeah, it's obvious, isn't it?
The plea deal itself, as I said before, is it worse from going into prison? Because I believe now he's in prison, they're already making his life hell because they're whispering through the vents, and apparently they've got some kind of system going, the inmates, where as one finishes, one takes over, so it's 24 hours a day, and they're sort of saying things to him through the air vents so we can hear them, like they're going to get him and stuff like this. And on the first day he was there, he put a complaint in, number one, which made me laugh, he put a complaint in about his food, that he didn't get all the items on his tray and he'd like to speak to the governor. And does he actually think he's staying in a hotel?
I think he's just so detached from reality.
I think so as well.
That he just... I don't even know, to be honest. There's some wires loose in there, isn't there?
That's what I was going to say to you before. That was the exact almost phrase I was going to use. It's like as if the wires are cut, that it doesn't...
There's like some disconnection between reality and what's actually going on.
Yeah.
That he probably thinks he's just at like a summer camp or something.
Yeah. I mean, don't forget, in prison, number one, he's hurt women. They don't like that. Women or kids, they don't like. But it's going to be some kind of badge of honour for whoever takes him out. And I actually do think that is going to happen at some point. The only way they're going to stop that, I think, is to keep him in solitary confinement. And the worst thing he did was he complained about the prisoners. So right away, he's a prison snitch right away. So as if he couldn't, the target on his back wasn't already big enough, it's now bigger. And there's going to be some moments somewhere down the line he's going to be left alone. It happened with Jeffrey Dahmer, didn't it? He got done in the shower.
Well, I also think, at the bare minimum, he deserves to stay in solitary confinement for the rest of his life. He doesn't deserve to have any other human contact.
Maybe he'd like that. But if you look at it, though, they're already saying now, in all probability, he's going to be able to finish his master's degree in prison. And, I mean, it is awful when you look, because it's like a big cage, and within that cage is another cage. And there's, like, seats with like a desk all moulded into one, so it's like halfway over, and the chain to it if they want to watch the TV.
Yeah, but the point being, he's took 4 lives.
He's
here,
still
so
alive and breathing, isn't
that's
he?
That's what I'm saying. Why should he get the, you know, why should he get to do anything?
So them kids he murdered are never going to be able to go to their graduation, finish their degree. Like, he's having the luxury of doing that in prison and eating his vegetarian meals, which the state are paying for, the taxpayers are paying for. And as I say before, I'm guessing he's going to get a book deal somewhere along the line or something, isn't he? He's going to be of interest to other people. And in a way, rightly so, because people want to know what makes him tick so we can be aware of it. But isn't that what he wanted, to be recognised?
I just don't see this as a win for the families in this case at all, to be honest. Yes, he's going to spend the rest of his life behind bars, but it just doesn't, the punishment doesn't seem fit for the crime that he committed.
If they do make his life hell in prison, though, maybe that's the best way. Personally, if it was me, I would want to see him shot. So that's just me. The King Road house loomed as a grim reminder. True crime followers made pilgrimages to see it. For locals, it was unbearable. Eventually, the University of Idaho announced it would be demolished. In its place would be something meant to heal, not to haunt. Scholarships were created in each victim's name. Candlelight vigils became annual traditions. The campus came together in grief and resilience. Yet scars remained. Students checked their locks twice, parents called constantly. Moscow was forever changed. And still, the biggest question remained unanswered. Why? Why these four? Why that night? Did Koberger know one of them? Was Kaylee the target, given her more severe injuries? Or was it about power, control and obsession? No motive was ever revealed. Perhaps none ever will be. So what we are left with is a chilling truth. A man who studied killers became one. Four young lives ended violently, without reason, without mercy. But their stories live on, not defined by the way they died, but by the way they lived. Madison, Kaylee, Zana and Ethan, friends, siblings, children, dreamers whose lives touched everyone around them. They are remembered not as victims of horror, but as bright lights who burned out far too soon. And though Moscow, Idaho will never be the same, their memory endures. So do you think we'll ever find out why? Do you think he'll ever say?
I don't think he ever will, because I don't think he has to. And I think, like you always say about these serial killers, they hold on to that power, don't they? It's the when they're in prison and everything's been taken away from them, it's the one bit of power that they can keep for as long as they possibly can. So being the narcissist that he is, and just the lack of emotion that he's shown through this entire thing, why would he?
I wonder what made him sort of... There must have been a moment when he had this idea to do this, but what was the reason? You know, why did he get that idea?
Because he's a freak.
But what makes him that, though? That's the question, isn't it? Do you think, though, the fact that he immersed himself in criminology, because as we know, there's a lot of true crime now. Years ago, it wasn't like this. Now, it's got its own channel, several channels. There's podcasts, just like ours today. People are very interested in it, but I think it's more the human nature side of it, because you do always wonder, why did this happen? That's the big question. But do you think immersing himself in that kind of environment actually kind of, obviously he was interested in it, but did that make the difference and made him kind of want to do it?
Personally, I don't think the criminology stuff like tipped him to do it more. I think he was already probably on this path before he went to study criminology. And I think, in my opinion, I think he probably went to study criminology to try and figure out how he could do it in the best way.
Do you think there's a possibility that he did this crime to just as a case, as a test point, to prove that you could do something and get away with it?
I think he's narcissistic enough to think that he probably could do it and get away with it, yeah. And I think he probably done it, and he's studied so many cases where they haven't got away with it, and he's thought, you know what, I'm going to try this and I am going to get away with it.
Because there's been a number of cases throughout criminal history that where people have decided to do that. Or do you think there's a possibility that maybe he wanted to get caught to prove something else?
I don't think, although the evidence looks like he's not even really tried to hide that much, I don't think he wanted to get caught.
Or did he want to get caught because that way everybody would know his name and it did make him someone? Because look at us talking about him now. And he's one of the most notorious figures in the prison where he's at. And, you know, so amongst criminals themselves, he's a name that everybody knows. Has it actually given him the recognition? Because before he was just Mr. Cellophane, wasn't he? He was invisible, wallpaper.
I think the hardest thing about this case is that we will never get the answers unless he decides to speak, which I don't think he will.
What's strange is his own professor said, they asked her, you know, will you study him? She said, well, I probably will, maybe at some point. That he was actually one of his students, and now she's going to be talking about him. Yeah, as usual. It's like, I always refer to Ted Bundy because, you know, he was studying law, but they actually had the intelligence and the brains, didn't they, to do it? But they went a different way. And I always find that really fascinating, really, because they had a choice in life, where some people don't really get that much of a choice, do they? But they did. They had all the equipment to be successful. Because another thing we didn't talk about was that he was a heroin addict at one point, and he actually...
He looks like one.
Well, he was quite large, let's just say. When you see pictures of him when he was younger, he had a lot of weight on him. And he decided one day, he was taking heroin, he decided to kick the habit, and he did. And to do that shows willpower, doesn't it? And strength of character. So he did that. He lost all of this weight. He had an operation, I think, to remove excess fat and stuff, you know, that was left. And so he sort of reinvented himself. So he had that kind of willpower, didn't he?
I know, but I think if it's in you, it's in you. And nothing anyone can say, nothing anyone can do will change that.
It was kind of like he like he turned his life around though. But maybe there was some defining moment where he wasn't, I think he wasn't successful with women, and it made a hatred of women, and that's what he decided to do because of it. That was his answer. Right, everyone, that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.